listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez. And before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got the one and only Bobby Osinski.
Hey, Mike. How's it going?
Doing good, Bobby. Next to him, we've got Scott Gershon.
Hi, Mike.
And next to him, we have Diego Stucco.
I'm trying to keep Scott awake.
And finally, right over here on my left, we've got the one and only, this is my show number 104.
Really?
Can you get the phone?
I cannot.
See, when you get to 104, you start answering phones.
No, up to 103, I would have gotten the phone.
Rob, the Iron Man Arbiter.
Hello there, Mike.
How you doing, Rob?
I'm doing okay.
Joining us today, we are honored to have composer Jason Hayes. Jason.
Hey, Mike. I am thrilled to be here.
Well, welcome, Jason. And Jason's done some really cool stuff. He's worked in video games, composed some music for a couple small little games, one being a little one you might have heard called The World of Warcraft.
What? Which one?
Never heard of it.
He also brought along his friend, Tim McDonald.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, no problem. Tim dropped him off, and then as he was driving away, I said, hey, just ask him to join us. So it's not too easy. it's not too hard to get on the podcast. But we got a lot of stuff to talk about. First thing I want to talk about is something that's kind of happened today. I don't know if any of you guys are familiar. You follow Google with the Google I/O that happened today, and specifically talking about some of the Android development. And you know, if you want to read about it, go online. There's a lot of tech blogs that you can check out. But the one cool thing that really struck out to me, and if you go to the website Create Digital Music, which was the support in the new Honeycomb version of Android for devices. On the Google Android for tablets. So now you can not only plug in like cameras and things like that, but they also support things like joysticks, and they also support things like gamepads, but also USB audio, and even talking about MIDI and things like that. And I look at that, and it's just, you know,
so does that mean you're going to get rid of your iPad?
No, we're going to add. We never get rid of. No, but what it does mean is I think we're in the middle of a paradigm shift. I mean, you're going to see, you know, much like laptops replace the desktop, you're going to see slowly the tablet becoming more and more powerful and more useful for composers and musicians and doing things that you just never would have guessed. I mean, you know, I can easily see a Pro Tools DAW running on Android in a couple of years. And it's just being normal, you know, and being fast and being able to do all the processing. And I just think that's amazing that, you know, going through all these different paradigm shifts. I mean, how many of you guys remember the first time you were working on music or sound on a laptop? How amazing that was.
Oh, yeah.
That was like, I get to take it with me and I don't have to haul around, you know, that big giant tower and stuff like that. And now that we're doing, you see this Android and the Android development, it really, really shows what's on the horizon. And I think that's pretty exciting. I know we talked about this a little bit before, but any thoughts, guys? Do you ever see yourself working on a little pad like that?
To me, it's interesting because I want to see what people can come up with. They will be able to build their own devices, customized.
Right.
And so maybe someone will be able to build a new type of device, like a combination of a controller and software and blah, blah, blah. And it will build, it's not going to be based on any specific. I mean, I have an idea. I take this part, and I put it together.
Yeah, no, that's true. With the new SDK kit that they have, what Diego was talking about is now they're making it really open and anybody can write their own little APIs. Actually, they're writing little APIs which will allow you to use them to use the I/O of any kind of sensor to talk to Android. And so there's going to be a lot of really cool stuff that we don't even think about. But one thing I will say is, you know, having an iPad, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the whole touchscreen because it gets dirty, and sometimes you have to look where your finger lands, and that, I think, is the biggest downfall of touchscreens in general. I mean, you know, working your synths or working your consoles or your desk, a lot of times you just know where stuff is, and you do it by touch and by the knobs and things like that. And the fact that now, you know, they're allowing you to have I/O through, you know, the USB port so you can design your own stuff, I think that's really going to take it to the next level, that just a touchscreen, no matter, you know, how hard Apple says, you know, touchscreen, it's not the future.
I agree. You
still need that touch. You still need to be able to navigate your way around something as opposed to just a smooth surface.
I think one of the interesting things at this last Computer Game Developers Conference, GDC, was seeing how many games. I mean, the iPad is becoming the next game platform.
Right.
You know, people going from the DS, you know, the mobile plant games, to the iPad. And everyone was showing me these amazing iPad 2 games. And I mentioned to them, hey, what about Google? Google's coming out. It's really interesting. What great opportunities. But they started running into similar problems that they had with the PC early on.
Uh-huh.
And that is, well, we know what the hardware is on an iPad. We can build for it. We can optimize for it. When we go to Google, we don't know what the hardware is going to be. So it's hard to sit there and optimize because they are taking the technology to the nth degree.
Right.
The graphics and the game stuff that I saw was mind-blowing on a little portable tablet. For them to do that, is it Samsung? Is it, you know, Motorola's? Who's making it? And a lot of times, some people are going to say, well, we just made it as a reader or just as a netbook / tablet. So I guess the question is going to be, you know, once it starts becoming more prevalent in music, they'll go, oh, I want to get the cheapest tablet, only to find out it really doesn't work on that hardware. So now all of a sudden, I remember all the PC problems we had was the cards that were, nothing was really worked. But you can get only these PCs would work, but these wouldn't. But then they would change something, and they changed their design. They didn't tell anybody along the way that they had modified something in the hardware that now doesn't work with that piece of software. So I remember between buying video games and music stuff, on the PC was always hit and miss. Maybe works, maybe it doesn't.
Well, actually, Google has kind of addressed that problem because in their new Android operating system refresh called Ice Cream Sandwich, they realize the fragmentation, and that's actually one of their top things is they're trying to address fragmentation. So essentially, if it runs Ice Cream Sandwich, it's going to run your application. And some of the deals that they've put out there were, if you want Android and you're a cell phone manufacturer, you need to have updates for 18 months afterwards. And so I think they know about that. But
don't you think the music people are going to be pushing beyond that? I mean, people go, oh, look, it's a reader. Netbook. It's a phone.
But that's the interesting part to me, because I see people creating their own devices and selling them as a kit.
Right.
It creates like a little alternative market to the mainstream market of tablets. It's already happening. There are already out there kits that people can buy, and they can mount them on the chassis they like. So you have your own customized machine, and it sounds...
See, it would be great if a music manufacturer tied in with a hardware company to run Google. So it's like, here's the tablet, here's the Google, here's our software, here's the new Alesis / Roland /
And that's going to happen because I think musicians and techies in general, they follow the application. So once somebody comes up with a killer app that runs on Android, believe me, they're going to sell pads because people are going to want to buy the software. People are going to want to buy...
So as a guitar player, I can do one with my left hand, one with my right hand, and just start...
Be careful what you wish for. It might happen.
Play slide guitar, you know.
Who here has a tablet?
I do.
Yeah. I think we all do. Do you have a tablet?
I do. I just bought one. But I'll tell you, it's not the killer machine I thought it was going to be.
I agree. I bought the pinball machine. It's not like the real thing.
No, as a reader, the iPad 2 works great, but I haven't found anything besides GarageBand that makes me crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to follow your needs. You're going to follow the software. For me, you know, this week I mixed another commercial for a Well, I can't tell you who it's for.
I was going to say, can you actually talk about
it? No, but I will tell you this. I used two things to do all the sound effects. I used my iPad, and I used the Scott Gershon approach, which I did most of it with my mouth. So I did a lot of whoosh and a lot of, you know, pops and stuff like that. Because, you know what, there's this organic thing about your voice that you just can't get with swooshes. And believe me, I've got a library of a gazillion swooshes, and they all sounded electronic-y, and this was a very organic-sounding piece. And as a matter of fact, in the soundtrack, there was a guy whistling. So I kind of wanted to pay homage to the soundtrack by making it sound kind of organic. And
what,
so
a Morricone soundtrack?
As soon as it comes out, I'll tell you. But
what app did you use?
There's two apps. I use Curtis because it does granular, and you
which
have
cool.
a ton of control. And it's probably my go-to for, like, if you ever want an odd-sounding sound effects fast, go to Curtis, because you can just
so I'm going to love Curtis once the IO works.
Yeah.
Because I was trying to do your version when I was doing Green Lantern. And it was just a little too hokey for me.
Yeah.
Just how to interface with it, and it then, you know, going through the mic, and then coming out of the mini connector and trying to
Scott, come off that ivory tower. Join us common folk for a second.
It's okay if it's a small connector.
It
doesn't have to be an XLR
small
all
connection
the time.
Does not equal small
it
sound.
It starts from ASMU and up.
I need an IO for it.
Yeah, no, you do, and that'll come. But also, and Bobby, the other one I like to use is Xsynth, and specifically because you can manipulate your sounds with the multi-touch, and that's
is that Rudis's program? But you said you mixed it. Did you mix it on the pad?
No.
Sound source.
There's a sound source. I come up with a small connector.
Did you try the Moog Filtertron?
That's a good one. Yeah. That's a good one. But so just those little things.
It's amazing.
Things.
I mean, even the little Korg. I'm impressed with it.
Yeah.
But it's a great way, like, if you want to play with ideas. See, what I would love to do is be able to create an play with it.
Right.
Sit on the couch, come up with ideas.
Well, that's what I do
convert
with it.
It,
yeah.
And then take that and then convert it to my rig, and then use it there.
Yeah, and I think that's coming, not only with the
and
iPad,
can't do it?
But I
oh,
think
you
with,
know
yeah.
what, you know what
with Android, it's coming too.
There's another audio application called Audio iJack. It can record everything that happens on your computer.
Right.
Wouldn't it be cool to have something like that on the iPad?
No, I mean, there's
you don't
a ton
have to worry about
things.
The IO, because you can just export the file. You record everything that happens inside.
Yeah. So all that... Oh, go ahead.
What I've mainly been doing for music production is using an application called Music Studio. It's nothing to do final music composition, but boy, it's a great sketchpad, because in the past, I would have my, you know, Oxygen 8 keyboard, and I'd have my MacBook Pro, and I'd have all this stuff, and it would take me, you know, a long time to get set up in the cafe for the convenient music composition. Yeah. But with this thing now, I just load it up, and it actually takes advantage of the touch screen really nicely, and you can do some and export it all to MIDI.
And one thing I love about the iPad, because we're talking about, you know, what do you use it for, and I originally bought it as a reader, and I'm still yet to use it as a reader. So what I find I'm doing with it is really strange things. I find it is the king of casualness, and what I mean by that is, like, I've got all the video game machines at home and all of everything. But I never have time to sit down,
set it up,
do all these things, and it creates a commitment to do something. And a lot of times it'll be like, everybody's got 20 minutes they're waiting for something.
Yeah.
Whether doctor's office or, well, even 20 minutes. So you've got this short little bit of time. I find I take my iPad out, and I'm usually either messing with synths, I'm playing Angry Birds or some form of video game.
It's not productive.
Right.
I must have two or three dozen video games
nice.
On my iPad. Because and my son
is that
and I
all?
Yeah, well. and all these little things you want to tweak.
Right.
As well as I love a thing for CNN.
Yep.
I love the way their whole page is totally different, where it's just pictures and you're doing videos. So I'm reading more, I'm in the morning, forget the newspaper, just sit with the iPad, and all of a sudden, I'm reading off of that.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, we're in the middle of a paradigm shift, and it's kind of exciting to see where it's going to go. It's like, you know, we grew up with Moore's Law, how processors every 18 months always double in speed, and you start putting that on your little pads, and there's some exciting things coming up. Well, we're gonna segue onto the next thing that I want to talk about, because it kind of has to do a little bit with what we just finished, and that's I want to talk about data management. And the other day, I was going through some videos, cleaning out my digital camera for my daughter to use. And I remember this movie that I took of my youngest one in her first dance recital. And I shot it on this camera, and I don't know where it's at. And I know it's on a hard drive somewhere, but I just realized that, you know, for the longest time, you know, I get these things and I dump it out, and I dump the data and I dump the data, and you start losing track. You think you're going to remember which hard drive you put on. And if you know me, I've got a gazillion hard drives. I mean, I've got a ton of hard drives, so I'm going to be looking for this clip forever. But you know, it got me thinking about data management. We had some people asking on the Facebook page about data management, and I wanted to talk to you guys about data management. Not only what we do with our studios, but how do you handle data management with your life? Because think about this: in the old days when you shoot video, you had a tape, right? And you just got the tape, and after you shot it, let's face it, most of us put it on the shelf or put it in a bookshelf or whatever. So then there's your tape. And you shoot another one. There it is, another one. 10 years later, you come back. You still have your machine. You want to play it. You pull one tape off. You put it in. Oh, that still works. You pull another tape out. Oh, wait, this one's not that good. But you just lost just that one tape. Now, you have a generation worth of digital assets that you can lose just like that, and that's kind of scary. That kind of freaks me out a little bit. I mean, I just recently started backing up religiously and started backing up all the important files that I had, because think about it, you know, with the size of hard drives growing exponentially, you know, you can pick up a 1.5 terabyte Traveler hard drive, small one, for $160. 1.5 terabytes, you know, I mean, how much video and pictures can you put on that? And if that thing goes, forget it.
It's funny because dealing with sound design and sound effects, we have massive right. libraries. So in addition to our company's library, and we have big server system, et cetera, et cetera, what I've done personally, and I've researched it out quite a bit for what I was looking for, and the two that I came up with that are really nice is the Drobo
right.
and the Thakus. And what I like about the Drobo is it uses iSCSI.
Right.
Or FireWire 800. And I have 16 terabytes, but it's redundant, so it comes down to about 12 terabytes. And I've lost drives. And you just take the drive out, it refigures it, you pop a new drive in, and it's no big deal. And I've got two of them in two different places, because we do live in California, and the ground moves around. And I figured the chances of losing both of them, because it's everything to me. I mean, it's my whole library.
Right.
And use SoundMiner as the management system for it.
Now, what about for your, you know, personal photos and your personal videos?
To be honest, it's something that I personally do my own. In the fact that I don't have a special librarian system for that, I have a file management concept that I just do that I know that, you know.
Like small hard drives? Do you spread it amongst?
No, nope, you know what? I don't do that anymore. I've got all my hard drives are sitting there, like, rusting. It got to the point with, including my sound effects library, I have doubles ups of everything, all the photos, on these RAID systems.
Right.
And I've got them on a dual redundancy, so I can lose two drives.
I gotcha.
And it's great. And the Thakus is also very, very good. What I liked about the Drobo, which I went with, I wanted something a little bit easier. The Thakus takes a little more to set up. And the Drobo, literally, you take it out of the box, you plug it in. You say, how many drives redundancies do you want? One or two?
My buddy Charlie swears by the Drobo.
Yeah.
And he just says it's incredible.
Yeah. And so I just put it in, done, put the drives, mount it in. You can have different types of drives,
right.
different size drives, doesn't matter.
Rob.
Yes, Mike.
How do you handle your data management?
How do I handle my data management? well, I'll tell you, for the stuff that isn't
super critical. What I generally do, like if it's from cameras and you know just mobile recording devices and all that stuff, I generally keep two copies. I keep a raw, what I call a raw copy, which is just basically a copy of the entire memory card from the camera every time it fills up,
right.
Or a copy of you know whatever the media is coming in on. And then when I get a chance, I then sort it by project or by event. So what I'll generally have then is two copies of everything because I'll have it unsorted and raw, right. Which is the quickest, easiest way to get it out of the camera without worrying about anything. Right. And then when I have time, I'll put, okay, this was a birthday party, so put all those in one folder.
Right.
And then I'll usually, if I'm going to refer to media, I'll refer to it by what event it was for. Because down the road, you know, I'm going to remember I want to see the pictures of this birthday party. But if I do need to go back to the original raw data, I can always search by date and know that it's there. But the best technique I've heard for backing up, though, actually involves three copies.
Right.
And that is one copy, or I'm sorry, two local copies on different kinds of media.
Yeah.
So like DVDs and hard drives, and then a third copy that's off-site with whatever media you want. So for the most critical stuff or for important projects that would cost you a lot of money if you couldn't get them back, that's the best scheme I've found. But yeah. We don't use tapes anymore just because hard drives are so cheap and convenient.
Jason, yeah. What about you?
Well, I'm thankful for the fact that like the project I'm working on right now, we have the whole server thing and it's constantly backed up because personally I suck at this. I'm really bad at it. Yeah. I mean, I've got a time capsule that I rarely check in on and make sure it's still doing what it's supposed to do.
Oh, is it like haven't backed up in 43 days?
Yeah. So it's that. And I've got DVDs and right. And my wife is just a huge photo person. And so we do DVDs and, we've been bitten a couple times with our iPhoto library, just kind of vanishing or corrupting.
Yeah,
that's a really scary thing. So we have so many things in there, but she's done a lot of DVD backups in the time capsule, and that is about it. I mean, I've tried the online services, and I've never gotten a full backup. I mean, I've waited for weeks, and it's still trying to do it, and I'm just like,
well,
is there a good one? I don't know if Carbon, I don't know which ones are good.
Here's the interesting thing. I mean, you got like Gobbler, Backblaze, Mozy, Carbonite, and Justin, what was that one you were talking about?
Backblaze, I was looking into. What was the other one? It'll come to me.
Okay.
You know what's also good if you could do synchronized drives to Dropbox.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, though. You know, with a lot of those online sites, okay, what's happening is our hard drives are getting bigger. Which one?
Crash Plan? That's the one that a lot of guys are using, Crash Plan.
Cool. Justin is the animator from DreamWorks, in case anybody out there wants to know what that voice was. Nice to have you with us, Justin. The problem with backup systems is our hard drives are getting bigger, and ISPs are starting to put data caps on...
I read about it.
Yeah. ...on home users. So, you know, are you going to use half your data cap for backup? I mean, it's a great idea. I was looking into it. I actually had to come up with a whole system for Martin because he lost a drive, and so we had to rebuild some stuff, and I had to back it up. And I did what Rob did. We did a 3-2-1, basically. We have three copies, and two of them are there, and one of them's off-site. With the data caps, it's I see that being a problem with the backup online.
Oh, yeah.
Some people have a great... Once you get the initial backup done, the day-to-day backup is super easy. It does it by itself. It's really easy. And some of the Backblaze will also back up not only your computer, but it'll back up any drives that are connected to your computer, which is kind of cool. A lot of them only back up what's on your main drive. But I think with data caps, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the people that use that. So it's a great idea because it's kind of like the ultimate backup solution because it's off-site and it's, you know, on some, you know, out there in the cloud.
Does your garage count as an off-site?
I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how these the data caps affect it. Tim, what do you use to back up your stuff?
I have several hard drives, and I have them backed up in a couple of different places, just like he was saying, three places to back up. I use OneDrive for Time Machine backups for my Mac. Then I have some sessions on another drive and have those backed up on yet another drive. And then another drive, in a safety deposit box.
Wow.
It's not a bad thing. It's pretty offside.
And that one doesn't get backed up as often.
You got to be careful with the drives, because sometimes if you sit and let a drive sit for 6 months to a year, you pop it back on and it won't work.
One other thing in this day and age, because hard drives have gotten so cheap, it's a really good idea to steer away from any kind of backup that puts things in a proprietary format. The best thing you can do is back up the raw files, because you have the best chance of being able to get those back.
That's a good point.
A dozen years from now.
Did somebody find out what the lifespan of solid state storage is? Because I know hard drives, if you don't use them after a while, they just stop turning.
They do.
Well, solid state has a limited number of reads and writes, more than the amount of time. It's the number of reads and writes is limited.
So theoretically,
so they're guaranteed to fail after a certain number, but that number varies from device to device.
But in other words, if you take it, back it up, take it, and then put it in a safe deposit box, and theoretically, there's no moving parts to go wrong.
That's true. But one thing about a lot of the technology that's coming out with not only solid-state drives, but actually the high-density platters that we're getting so we can have these outrageous size hard drives is people don't know how they age yet. I mean, they have a theory how they age, but they don't know how they age. They haven't solid state drives haven't even been around, 10 years in the version that they are right now. Right. And you can't rely on the version that we've had. You could buy, back in the 90s, you could buy a solid state hard drive. It was going to cost you $9,000, but it's all, it was all RAM, and it was like, 10 gigs or something.
The thing is, I just cleaned out my garage, and I had Omega Zip drives, Jazz drives, Jet drives, and then had...
Do you need more?
and then you had the 9 gigabyte, the 50 gigabyte, the 100, the 250, the 500s, the 750s, the what? And I've got all these drives that I just need more of.
Or maybe you should open a museum at some point.
Yeah, And then you think, and then you sit there and you look at that pile in the side and go, that's like 10 grand.
Yeah.
That's crazy. And now you can buy 2 terabyte drives for, $110 per drive? And
it must be that the data cap thing on the online is just a temporary thing, because isn't cloud computing just this huge, wave of the future?
For companies. All be in the cloud? Companies, yes. But this is for...
But you're storing it in somebody else's system.
Well, but part of the problem is what they're putting the cap on is your access to that cloud. So the cloud has a massive amount of data storage, but you still got to get to it. So they own the pipeline that gets you to it.
So it's bandwidth.
It's bandwidth.
So instead of having a storage unit, you store, it'll be data store. So you pay $1,000 a year, and you get your shed that's a 10x10, and it's got X amount of memory. And
just like everything else, it's like our needs are quickly growing faster than our capabilities. I mean, we all need, 1 gigabit connections, but the capabilities of everybody having that, it's just not there yet, especially when you start moving around all your data. I think the last thing I want to say on the whole data thing is two things. Number one, you got to be disciplined to actually use any type of data management system that
clean your room.
that's it. I mean, you got to be disciplined. You got to, organize yourself. But the second thing is it's not, your data is not set and forget. It is, you always have to be aware of it and think of it as just, a member of the family, and, as you're moving, you got to move it along with you, because really nowadays, you have the ability to really wipe out a generation, a lifetime of memories by doing something really stupid, And it's just, and even sometimes it's not even, your fault. It could be
the drive doesn't mount.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's nothing worse than wanting to work on something and you plug that cable in and it just, does not show up.
That's why I'm a little cynical over data management systems and compared to files. Let me just take the files. I see them. I don't want to have something in front, like a friend of ours had a whole photo memory system and she couldn't find certain photos. I just want to know, where are the files? Where can I see them? Can I put them in folders? Can I manage them rather than it being a program that gets corrupt and oops and, know.
Well, how do you manage them then?
That's the thing. The data management is actually managing the files.
You know what it is? It's old school, and I guess for me it's like you've got a filing cabinet. What I'm finding now is my filing cabinet is going digital. So you put pictures, and you say, here's the pictures for 2010, and here's the pictures of my kid,
right,
and here's the pictures of the project.
But just what Mike was saying before, you have these huge drives and you don't know exactly what's on them. And what I do is just, it's old school. I take a picture of the files and just tape it to the drive so I know.
That's genius. That's a great idea too. Because and I actually knew somebody who did that, who on their backups would put a little JPEG of the file structure so they didn't have to open it up. They could just go to the JPEG.
I used to do that 15 years ago when I was still backing up on DVDs with FileMaker.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. It said nothing.
It was basically just taking, it wasn't a picture, it was just a directory, just a list of the files.
Just a screenshot.
Yeah.
But with your data in general, not only do you have to take control of the actual individual files, but you got to take control of the naming of the files because, you know, if you want to look for that photograph, I guarantee you, you're not going to be able to remember, you know, in 2 weeks, IMG-07431.
But you create a folder, and say Hawaii trip.
Yeah.
Boom, and dump it all in there.
Really, it's all about managing not just where you're putting it, but
have
where
a wife.
Where you're Justin, were you going to say something?
I had some thoughts, but I'll wait.
Yes, a wife is good.
Regarding the wife or regarding the backup system?
Backup
system.
All right. Well, hey, I'll tell you what. We're going to – oh, by the way, Jeremy, while we were talking, he found out that the SSDs are supposedly good for about 1 million cycles. So 1 million reads and writes.
Nice.
So that's
That's about 2 weeks.
By the way, when I was at NAB, I saw a presentation from Intel about the new SSD drives, and the cost and everything. It was some quite interesting data there because the amount of energy that a regular hard drive takes and everything. So
better, worse,
much better. Like a huge saving, huge.
Not spinning a motor.
Yeah.
The other thing with the solid state drives is a lot of them now come with really long warranties, like 5-year warranties, which means they believe it's going to last that long, and if they're wrong, they're going to replace it. So you know, most hard drives don't make it 5 years.
Because I've got an intimate relationship with Western Digital. Yeah. You just cycle through those drives.
Well, there you go. My only thing about solid state drives is like, you know, it does some voodoo to store your data on it in the solid state.
Well, there's a word. There's a word that comes to mind. There's a word that comes to mind, and that word is bzz, because that's all it takes for the whole thing to be gone.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's like, you know, I don't trust them yet. You know, at least a hard drive that has a platter that spins and anything that spins and you can put a playback head on it.
Until it stops spinning.
Yeah, but you can take it someplace.
You know what? He's not here tonight, but young Mr. Summerfield from our panel, he had some issues. He bought a new 12-core Mac with a bunch of solid-state drives, and one of them was a system drive, and it already started to flake on him and give him some errors. And they replaced it. But, you know, that's pretty scary.
No, that is very scary.
You know what would be great is next time, I forgot the girl's name from NASA, that she came down, she was doing all the data management.
Well,
that would be a wonderful person to ask.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, just take control of your data. Always, you know, don't get complacent with it. And I think as long as you manage your data and don't let your data manage you.
Is it data? That's what Farm Town's for.
All right, well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Jason about writing music for video games. So we'll see you on the other side.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking about data management, and during the break, boy, did we get some great information that we did not record. That's all I can say.
Just so you guys know.
You know, all that stuff that you probably wanted us to cover, it was covered. We just didn't record it. So we're going to have our good friend Justin back, and we'll talk all about that. But moving on, we're honored to have Jason Hayes with us. And one of the things that Jason's done was he did the score. He was the lead composer on World of Warcraft, correct?
Yes.
And we're going to talk a little bit about composing for video games. And but before we do that, let's talk about your background. How did you get involved with World of Warcraft? And did you know it was going to be what it turned out to be and all that good stuff?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I was writing jingles in Louisiana and doing all right with that, I guess. And then just one day I thought, I have to get involved with video games because I'm a gamer, and you know, it had to be easier to do that than to work on major motion pictures or
right.
a hit TV show. And at that time, it probably was a little bit easier. So now, not so much. You know, now they got guys in film and TV that'll call me and say, "Man, how do I get involved with video games? That's like a hot thing."
So, there's no future in it. Just
Don't worry.
So yeah, so it was great. You know, years later, after I got started, I was at Blizzard, and they said we're going to do this massively multiplayer online game and try to get involved with this, and no one had any idea that it would be the huge hit that it is.
And so when you first started working with Blizzard, first of all, were you doing some titles before that? Did you do any like Diablo or StarCraft or any of those titles? Or?
I started out about the last 9 months of StarCraft. So we were, you know, in pretty fast on the deep end on StarCraft, and then went on to all the other titles, Warcraft 3 and Diablo 2 and numerous titles with them before we ever got involved. And before there was World of Warcraft, there was another experimental title that was a new IP, and we ended up changing course and deciding, let's just make World of Warcraft, and that was a good decision. So, but yeah, for many years I was involved with all their other titles before that point. So,
now what background do you have? Did you go to school for composing? Did you?
Yeah, I went to the University of North Texas and I studied composition there, and you know, learned a lot about jazz that I didn't expect. I didn't go there for jazz, but you can't help but get sucked into the jazz vortex right. at UNT, and that was a great experience. You know, the composition department was a little bit of a strange experience because they were really into their avant-garde music, and so, you know, my interest in film music and, you know, this tonal music wasn't really their style at the time. So, yeah, so I got a little discouraged at the school, but I learned a lot while I was there. I think studying piano there, and they did this cool thing where if you were a piano player, you could do anything else from semester to semester. But if you did anything but piano as your main instrument, you had to do piano. So for me, it was great. I spent some time in the men's course. I spent some time playing the harp, of all things,
nice.
which was cool. You know, I had a great teacher. I didn't deserve such a great teacher, and she was really interested in me. She said, "Well, you know what? We need you to be in harp. You know, we need more good heterosexual harp players, you know." But it was fun. It was a great experience there.
That's awesome. And so you got the job. You're working at Blizzard. They come up and they say, "We're going to do this massive multi-online, you know, game." What kind of direction did they give you? Because first of all, let me tell you, the music for World of Warcraft, that was one of the best things when you started playing that, is the music was really good. I mean,
thanks so much.
You nailed a lot of the environments. You nailed the things I liked are the transitions when you went from one area to another area. When you go from the Barrens to, you know, any place else. You know, I mean, there's so many subtle music cues
throughout the whole thing,
and it's done really well. Especially the opening. Did you do the opening cutscene? Did you compose that? That was pretty awesome. So what, you know, give us a little insight on your creative process to come up with some of those themes, and with, like, you know, Thunder Bluff and all that. Yes, my inner nerd is coming out.
I was just saying, playing the game lately.
No, it's great. You know, it's great. And of course, I didn't write all the music. There was some fantastic composers, you know, that I got to work with at the time. And, you know, and since the original release, they've put in some ridiculous amount of music, like on the order of, you know, 20 plus hours.
Wow.
So it's become this huge collection, this library of stuff. But early on, it was great because they'd give me concept art to look at. And I would just look at this kind of this forest shot that someone drew, this beautiful picture of a forest with, you know, the sun coming through the trees. And I'd write a piece of music for this thing. And then they'd say, "Hey, guess what? We have the early version of, you know, Elwynn Forest ready. Right. So come take a look." And I would log into the game and then you know, hear the music. And sometimes it'd be a nice surprise. It would just work out really well. And other times they change the direction and it wouldn't, you know, be as appropriate. And, you know, it's a little bit of a of a misdirection to write music for a beautiful painting, a digital painting of a forest in the morning, because I'm imagining I'm there by myself. You know, I've got the sunlight and I have this nice, you know, solace of a morning scene. But then, you know, of course, in the game, there's no guarantee you're not by yourself and you could be fighting some monster. And so, you know, it's not really a reliable way to do it. At the same time, it was nice to get a tone for the area. And a lot of the music in the game is based on just geographically where you're standing. It's not based on knowing exactly what the player's doing at that moment, although it's become more sophisticated over time, but mostly it's based on where you're standing. So you do the best you can.
Yeah, because it works really well. Let me ask you a question that's totally going to be really geeky.
I love this.
Did you like the music on the Alliance or the Horde, which are the two factions in that? I mean, and basically you can pick one of the two sides, and they each, when you start, they have definite different distinct sounds, and they have definite distinct
I think your inner nerd just became an outer nerd.
It must have played this morning.
Have you seen the South Park thing of this?
I just want to tell you as the host, I do my homework, that's all.
Right. Okay. Yeah, good excuse, my
So, you know, it's hard to say one or the other. I think as a game player, which I played a little bit of World of Warcraft, I think the Alliance is my side. And maybe that does kind of feed in somewhat. Although, you know, getting really tribal and this kind of brooding, you know, presence of the traditional kind of orc side of things is a really fun thing to
write
for.
Did you write for both?
I wrote for both, yeah. I kind of sprinkled in music on both sides of it and kind of established.
It's interesting, you know, how you switch your brain to one side to the other. You become...
Well, you know, the funny thing about it is, honestly, it's like in doing, say, like, the, you know, Capital City, you know, Orgrimmar, you've got this, it's a very kind of a big brass drums. It's kind of almost what you'd expect. I tried to do something that hopefully was kind of creative, but honestly, when it comes to like Stormwind, I felt a lot more like I was able to pick up on a more subtler lyrical feeling about it, because it's like they're heroic and they're powerful, but there's also kind of a sense of, oh, this is home. And I just felt there was a little bit more of a delicate emotional arc, you know, to some of that stuff.
Well, that's the one thing too that I wanted to point out is your music adds a lot of emotion. And I think that was one of the great things about that game was, okay, the gameplay was great and it was pretty fresh and original, but you really, you know, the score really plays a big part in setting the scene and laying out where you're going to be at. It kind of introduces you to where you are and you know, the tribal stuff that you do for the orcs and all that. I mean, that's perfect because you really could that's exactly what it would sound like if you went over there. And then it just kind of it allows your imagination to really connect. And I think the music plays a bigger part than people think it does because it really sets you up and it's really a good example of how video game music should play its part in the whole thing. You should not know that it's affecting you as much as it is affecting you.
Yeah, well, that's the challenge too, because you've got these areas that you sit in for. You know, it's not like you're going to sit there for 5 hours or 10 hours. You're going to be there for maybe, if it's successful, 5 years. So how to score, that's kind of a challenge. But I just started out writing some major overarching themes, very kind of linear. Let's make a statement about, you know, what is the Alliance about? Let's make a statement about the Horde and doing these things. And then when I went to do the music in the actual game, I picked up on those themes and referenced gestures of melodies and kind of moments that would pick up on those themes. So a lot of the times, the main kind of overarching world themes aren't really expressed in the game at all. They're just a reference point. So I could then sprinkle in these little gestures that would make you feel like, oh, wow, this is hinting at this much kind of bigger a piece of music that maybe you don't ever quite hear in its entirety or quite as linearly. It kind of becomes this thing that can blend into the background.
Now, did you have to write like a master cue and then a ton of little small cues? How does that work? How does that work in that type of a platform of an MMO?
Well, we went through a few different iterations, and in one iteration, I had a long piece of music that would kind of play, say, for, you know, the Enchanted Forest or the dark kind of Sleepy Hollow areas of the game or whatever, and this long thing, and then the programmers would work on making it come in at some random point in the music and kind of fade in for a while and then go away. And it turned out to be kind of a failed experiment because, you know, you'd come in the middle of a piece of music and it wouldn't really give you that satisfying feeling of it didn't make that much sense. And so we did the same thing but with a little bit more intention. So I made shorter snippets of music that were based on a longer suite, and then I could plan out how it would come in. It still would fade in and feel like something that you're just kind of coming into the scene in a subtle way, but at least we knew where we were beginning and where we were ending. Although, you know, the design was to not have it feel like the music's ending now. It's more like music kind of goes away and you're left with ambient sound effects. But it kind of became this thing of short pieces of music that would come in for a while and then and go away at times that would make you kind of wonder if it was maybe still playing in the background somewhere.
Right.
You kind of, you know, it was supposed to blend in and feel like something that you wanted to keep on. It wouldn't become annoying, and it would become something inseparable from the experience, like the fog effects or the lighting effects. It just added an atmosphere that would kind of creep in.
Is the music baked in, or is it dynamic?
It's pretty baked. I mean, there's not a lot of dynamicism, you know, in the way it works. It's become more that way because they've embraced a much more scripted narrative approach to their storytelling. In the beginning, it's like you really do have a huge sandbox and you'd have these quests and, you know, kind of fun adventures you could go on. But there wasn't a lot of like the designers controlling what you're doing in a particular area. It was more like you were free to explore. And so there weren't a lot of extremely robust interactive programming schemes. But now, you know, as the game has evolved, I think it's great because they've embraced much more of a storytelling approach. And some people complain about it because they still like being free to do anything they want and play with their friends. And you can do that, but it's kind of nice. You know, as a composer, it's nice that they're taking a really grabbing hold of, hey, let's make sure there's a real important dramatic moment that we can build up to. And I think it's great to have the designers take a little bit more of a hand in making sure that your ride through the game, you know, there's someone who's helping make sure that your experience is more dramatic. And it's nice. But,
so are you writing cues more on spatial areas or events that are happening within that?
By far, there is a lot of just spatial areas. And then, you know, that was like two categories. So you had spatial areas that feel like they could blend into the background and you could just kind of hover there for a long time.
Sure.
And then they had other things that were spatially based that were based on like a capital city like Stormwind or a special outpost that was kind of dark and mysterious. And we would make that music a little bit louder and make a little bit more attention to itself. But then after that would play and establish itself, then you'd get the kind of the more background things that could play and kind of fade in a lot more into the background. And just a few cues that were battle-oriented, but there was never a huge battle implementation either. And that's kind of by design also, because you don't want to be out there beating on rats in the middle of a swamp and be hearing pulsing battle music, because it's just not an epic thing to do. You know what I mean? Maybe a big boss monster, but you don't want to be, you know, you don't want to oversell the idea of killing rats out in a field. It just doesn't, it kind of takes, it kind of makes you feel more mundane than it really is.
Right. It's not that heroic.
Yeah.
Or you build the music up. I've worked on a handful of projects where you always have to be sensitive to the dynamics of what's happening, either in gameplay, story, whatever, where if you overbuild the music, you're telling the player something that they're not seeing.
That's right.
So you go, okay, wow, I'm getting really jazzed up. My adrenaline's going. What do I do? And there's nothing to do. There's nothing going on.
That's right.
And it freaks people out.
Well, that's a huge example. Is like I always think of, you know, I hate to keep beating on this one cue from this one movie, but it was like the remake of Godzilla, I think it was, right? And they had this beautiful music cue, and you're following a helicopter.
But Godzilla sounded great, right?
Whatever.
We've got a lot of people that are
epic sound design.
Attached to Godzilla.
Epic sound design. But even this music cue is great. But I mean, you're going over the water, and the music is just saying, "Here we come. We're coming up to the moment," and you're just excited. And then you come up over the thing. It was like a construction site or something, and you just feel like it's such a letdown because the music told you it was a big deal, and it wasn't.
So, luckily, the sound design saved everything, though.
I will say that the music for the trailer was pretty awesome.
I'd have to co-sign that.
But no, it's a big problem because I just done a movie not too long ago, which no names, that what happens is producers who get very excited want everything to be big and cool.
Oh, yeah.
So, and with sound, and probably same thing with visuals, you only have so much space. So they go over to the composer and they go, make it really big. Make it the biggest I've ever heard. They go to the sound designer, make it the biggest I've ever heard. Go to the mixers, make it really big. Everybody then comes in with the biggest things they can think of.
like a plastic.
And then we start mixing it, and you put it. And of course, everything's just a car crash because nobody was talking to each other. And then you look at it, and then you try to make some sense of the mix, and then you play back the scene, and it doesn't work.
Right.
Because you go, wow, it sounds amazing. We've made something.
Right.
But then visually,
there's a cricket crossing the street.
You play through the scene, and you go, I'm missing something.
Yeah. You know what?
Where's the visual payoff?
One of the things that so many people seem to lose track of, including creative people with a lot of experience, is the only way you can tell something is big is if it's next to something small.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tension and release. It's all about contrast.
And I know 50% of the experience is sound. But here's the reality. It's not 80%.
Yeah.
It's 50%.
Right.
And one of the things I've seen is, you know what? We didn't shoot it. We didn't create it in a game for whatever reason, but sound will make it something.
Right.
And reality is you could get away with it a little bit. Little bits here and there. But if you're trying to do a whole project that you, for whatever reason, don't invest the money that needs to be invested visually.
Oh, yeah.
That audio, if you do it audio only, and I've done several projects that try to do that, it never works.
Well, yeah. How about a city where they say, oh, down this city street, we want it to sound like it's bustling. We want to hear people milling about, you know, and they've got no one in the street. It's for a game, right? Yeah, and they don't have any models walking around. Yeah. Well, you hear that in the city street, it's like, what is that? You know, it's like
they're all in the buildings.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. You can't see that. It's your fault. Yeah.
And everything needs to be balanced. Just if you've got, especially in video games, which I think are, because right now I think video games have surpassed TV visually. I think now they're tapping in with film. So you see the visuals on a film, you see the visuals in a game, and they're kind of neck and neck a little bit. The top films do some pretty impressive things, but the games have nothing to apologize with. But what happens is, if you get graphics that aren't good, you're going to have the best sound design, doesn't work. You get the best graphics with the worst music.
Oh, yeah.
And all of a sudden, what it really has to happen, it's a balance. And it's not one over the other.
Right.
And then if you get bad dialogue, how many times have we seen? Yeah. Bad dialogue or badly recorded dialogue.
Hey, follow me. Okay, let's go back.
You sit there and you're like, oh my God. You know, and it's so true. And you said, down to the guy who's recording it, give a little space, relax as an actor.
Right.
And give me something that's normal. You know, not the AM radio thing. Yeah. And so yeah, I mean, it's everything has to balance it out appropriately.
let me just change it up just a little bit. Now we talked about a little bit about your process and about everything. Let's go on back to the technical side of things. When you're working on video games, how does that work? Do you have a producer that gives you like a cue sheet and says we need these cues and we need them to be this long, or is there a programmer direct you and then you do it and give them back ORB files or MP3s or tell us the technical end of things?
Well, it's a pretty fluid process, and a lot of times it's going in there and kind of seeing what needs to be done,
right.
and you consult with producers and they kind of have an opinion and you kind of work that way. But you know, it's interesting how the deliverable files have really changed a lot, because you know, back in the day, it was, we want to use this Microsoft ADPCM and 22K, and it sounded really bad.
Right.
I mean, really, really bad. And then it said, we got 44, and fantastic. And, you know, but then, you know, we're going to use MP3 files. Hey, this is great, you know. And now, you know, the way I'm working is I don't even think about compressing any files at all. It all goes in completely raw. And then when they get ready to generate banks for the game, I can then make decisions carefully about, okay, what can I compress somewhat, and which things have to go in raw, which things can I really crunch, and what's nice is it's all stored in its completely raw format, and I can change those settings by just profiling the game and seeing how hard it hits the processor, and decide just how many AUG file, how many AUG Vorbis
right.
format files can I have in this game before it just chokes, or how many streams can I play. So it's nice not having to constantly compress files down and keep it as a malleable. As a malleable thing.
Now, do you work off of a cue sheet? I mean, how does that actually? Do they give you like a cutscene and then you do that cutscene, or do they give you gameplay video and then you compose to that? What's your visual reference on when you compose?
It's typically, in my experience, and it's different at every company. Some are extremely organized, but I've generally worked on projects where it's been pretty. Disorganized is the wrong word. It's kind of a controlled chaos thing,
right.
And there's a fluid. fluid. There's a lot of iteration. I mean, just a ton of iteration. And so you'll do a version, and hey, guess what? That was good, but we decided for gameplay reasons to scrap the whole area, bulldoze it, we're starting over again, right? And now it's raining, and it's dark, and it's dreary, and now all of a sudden you're rethinking the whole thing. And it's very iterative. So there's not like a – because I've worked in-house as part of the development team – You're kind of in from a very, very early part of the process.
Right.
And that's a great thing. If nothing else, to be an ambassador for audio and kind of have people thinking, hey, we have to develop programming time to this to build in the systems you need to really support the audio.
Right.
But from an iteration standpoint, you go on quite a ride. I mean, things get redone and redone and redone if you start really early. And that's been, you know, my experience a lot is that, you know, you're not getting these really detailed cue sheets. This is exactly what we need for sound design, exactly what we need for music. It's more like, you know, you're kind of having conversations and you're developing these ideas,
right,
and then you're going back through and maybe reworking them as necessary.
How do you go from cue to cue? Are you just crossfading? Or
yes. Basically, if you happen to be in a piece of music where it's of the subtle kind, where you're in a zone,
right,
you just get a crossfade. It may be like a 4-second crossfade to get from one to the other.
Is there any way to tell? I know, like, sometimes when we've done interactive music and gaming, we have a monitoring system that says how many measures, what measure you're on. So, in other words, if I want to introduce a new piece of music, I know that if I break it into, you know, 8 bars or whatever, that it will go to X bar and then play the new cue. So it automatically has data in it that lets me time out.
Right. Yeah. I'm doing a lot more of that now.
Yes.
But on WoW, it we didn't have that much of that.
Is that the proprietary system you guys use?
No, right now I'm working with Wyze.
Oh, Wyze, okay.
So we're doing it all with the audio middleware solution known as Wyze. And they
have,
you know, it's the funny about Wyze. Wyze is a great system, and it's very well organized from an interface standpoint. And it's very powerful. I mean, if I were to make up, it's like a guy told me, if I were to make up a system from scratch that would do everything I'd ever want to do, I might do things that Wyze can't do. But the system that works today, that people have spent, you know, years of manpower developing, is better than my fantasy system, which, you know, I may never get off the ground. So.
I mean, from just speaking from the gaming world, Wyze and FMod is basically Pro Tools in the window.
I got you.
So yeah. Wyze it's the standard that everybody uses.
How do you spell it?
W-I-I-S?
W-I-S-E.
Yeah, that's right.
Question. And they're fairly new, but they've really come in strong.
They've created stuff that will blow your mind, even on a musical seed.
Some of the systems for doing algorithmic sound design kind of engines, some of them are more impressive than others. But the adaptive music is very, very robust.
For example, when you this is a musical question. Do you have a dominant key across the entire game?
You know, that happened. I mean, I thought that it was brilliantly done in Red Dead Redemption. They said that everything's, you know, A minor or whatever,
right,
and it's all at this exact beats per minute. I'm not doing that with the
But
I
do
didn't
you
do
have do you have like I don't know from E to A sharp or stuff like that, or you float around a certain.
It's key. Tempting. It's tempting to do that because it could make an adaptive system,
right,
really work nicely. Because we didn't really have a robust system on WoW,
right,
I didn't concern myself with it. But even now, as I'm trying to do more of that, I tend to think first about just let me try to get some hopefully effective music.
Right.
Right.
And then I think about how can I fold this in. So there's a little bit of thought as to the system, but at the end of the day, you know, effective music is gonna be affecting, and so I try not to think too much about getting it to just pigeonhole into.
Right.
Although when I found out that they did all the Red Dead Redemption all in one key at one tempo, and it's as effective as it is, I thought, well, there's something to be said for actually giving yourself those limits, because it doesn't hurt for the fact that it's that limited. It's actually very effective.
Yeah, and you know what? The thing about
it paces
that
the game out.
That game, and the thing about it too is it. It feels more cinematic for some reason. I mean, it's like you're playing a movie. It really is. It has that feeling. And I didn't know that it was in the same tempo.
Can I ask a question? When you deliver the music, do you deliver stems that get mixed dynamically in the game, or are you just giving them stereo mixes?
The things I'm doing now with the current title I'm working on, we're definitely working a lot more in that exact way you're talking about.
Stems,
yeah, exactly. But we didn't do that before. So, yes, there is a lot of that. And then there's the whole dynamic mixing of the stems and things like that. And that is, you know, it's like it's a cheap trick. I mean, it's really, it's very easy to do. But what's so funny about that kind of technique is that you get so much mileage. It's such a high bang for the buck proposition. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you start lining up beats like, hey, I'm going to have this transition, but only on the downbeat. And, you know, that's very difficult to architect all the music to work that way. It can be done, and I like doing it, but it's expensive to author.
But you, right. remember, it reminds me of the old drum machines, the old sequencers.
Yeah.
Where you have patterns. You write a pattern, mm-hmm. and then you go to another pattern, and then you go to another, maybe because I'm showing my age now. and that's when we got into interactivity, especially interactive music, I'm like, I've been here before. Write a pattern, you write a little piece, and it goes to the next pattern. But what I think is great now with working off of stems is a lot of times you go, you know, I don't want to do the melody right now. I just want to keep time. Mm-hmm. So you keep time, keep a little atmosphere, you go. And then all of a sudden, just by changing it up, you can change so many.
Yeah, it's super effective, and it's relatively easy to do.
That's the way when I did the score for The Conduit, it was made that way.
Yeah.
It was thought from the ground to be a score like that, delivered in stems.
Well, the nice thing about the stems also is you're not saying, okay, I can make this change, but I need to wait 3.5 beats before it's eligible. You can do that any time, and it always sounds good. You just kind of morph from one version to another version, so it's a great...
You definitely have some weird ear candy, you know, weird trombones doing some stuff, and then all of a sudden, something happens in the game that triggers that. So it's like, it turns it on.
Yeah.
It's not even having to go to a different pattern. You can have this little pattern going and then start developing. You know what it turns a lot like is Ableton.
Nice.
It's really what it turns into.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing about that also is, I mean, this is getting interactive, philosophical. But, you know, we were saying earlier that one of the nice things is if you're taking charge of the storytelling more, having the designers determining some things about your experience by taking control a little bit more, but you still interact with it. Well, the stem thing is great because it's the marriage of the player is helping to control which stems come in and out.
Yeah.
But yet the content creator, the composer, you know, got to determine this whole structure that kind of says, you know, no matter what you do to manipulate the system, it's always going to kind of work and sound good.
It's going to sound like what you want it to write.
Exactly. Which is a great thing.
Online games is a little more challenging because there's a social side to it.
Right.
But when you've got a game that's actually you start here and eventually you're going to end here, whether it's a day or a month or a year, there is an arc.
Yeah.
Hey, Jason, we're gonna have to wrap things up right now. But before we go, I got to ask you if you're out there, if there's a student out there or somebody out there that wants to get into composing for video games, what kind of advice would you give them? What would you tell them to do? Should they learn the tools? Should they learn is there a way to teach themselves to compose for video games? I mean, what's
Sure.
Give me some advice.
Well, I mean, you know, there's the practical things like the places you can reach out to in order to get connected with the industry, just from a career building thing, and that would be, you know, going to the Game Developers Conference and hanging out with all the really friendly people. Yeah, of course, GANG, which is a great trade organization.
Which
around.
Is Game Audio Network Guild.
Yeah, it's a fantastic organization because they have events they sponsor at GDC, right? So when you go there, you've got people you can hang out with. It's a very friendly community. I mean, people at all levels, they just kind of hang out together and share tips and tricks. But, you know, just from a development side as far as skills, you know, in addition to learning all you can about, you know, your craft with music, it's like if you learn something like the WISE, if you knew how to author content in WISE, or you get to know FMOD, if you show you can implement your content in a kind of a robust, interesting way, I think that puts you way ahead. Because I know a lot of guys say, I just want to make cool music. They don't think about the implementation.
Right. You know, there's places. Berkeley's got a program. Expression College has got a program.
Yeah.
There's a lot of colleges now that are making courses for gaming. Because, to be honest, we're hiring the students.
Yeah.
Right now, if you don't know WISE or FMOD to come into our company...
Right. You better be good.
you better be really good. But that's kind of one of the requirements. Like it's like learning Pro Tools. You have to know the tool sets.
Well, and one of the cool things about knowing this kind of system is that basically if you learn this system, you are able to plug right into the development pipeline. Because now, in the past, you'd have to do these assets like a music cue or a sound effect and throw it over the fence – so that a programmer could make all your dreams come true,
right?
Right? But now you can actually control this content, put it in yourself. There's no programmer intervention really needed. And so this is why it's so important to use these tools effectively, because if you can do it, you can slot right into the development process with a team. And instead of having to throw them assets that they have to deal with, you can just integrate it.
Wow, that's amazing that now you have that kind of control, whereas before the composer was a little bit on the outside of it and like, yeah, we'll just tell so-and-so we need some music, and then you go write music.
That's
now,
one of the coolest things.
Now you're actually part of the inner circle, and you're working into the games themselves.
When you start realizing that it's $20 to $40 million to make a game that's going to make upwards of about $150 million in the first week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot at stake now.
Yeah, it's
awesome.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's no longer the, video games, my son plays it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for joining us, man. I mean, this has been pretty awesome, and it's not every day I get to talk about the Undercity and its theme.
I've enjoyed it thoroughly. I really appreciate being here.
Some really great insight. Some great insight to that game. Like I said, man, I mean, it's a good game. I haven't played it in a while, but I did play it, and really the music was responsible for a lot of its success, because it was very effective. You did a fantastic job.
Well, thanks, and I'm really impressed with your knowledge of World of Warcraft, actually. So
he played this morning.
It's really
lying.
Really
no, it's cool. All homework.
What do you do at work? Working on an orc. Leave me alone.
Yeah. Well, hey, we're going to have to wrap it up, but before we wrap it up, there's a couple things we need to touch upon. First of all, we're going to revisit Rebecca Black really quick. And a couple podcasts ago, we talked about that, and basically Rob said that if you want to get your kid into music, don't do it that way. and Bobby wasn't with us at that time, and he's with us now. And so I wanted to have Bobby tell us a little bit about his insight into the whole Rebecca Black phenomenon, and specifically with, with the streaming and things like that, and the benefits of YouTube.
Okay. Well, I can't tell you anything more than you probably know already, except for the income stream. I just checked. There was 135 plus million views on Friday. Now, for that, she probably made $4,100, or they made $4,100.
My goodness.
For that many?
Wow.
Now, what that, and basically what it is, for every 250,000 views, you make $7.60. Now, what this is this is the money coming from YouTube as a YouTube partner, from the advertising. So, If you extrapolate it out, that's $4,100. Okay, so that's not a lot of money. And what it makes you think is, no matter what, if you base your life on the number of views that you're going to get, you better be in it for fun, because you're not going to make a lot of money on it. Now, there's some other ways that you can make some money, but it's still not a lot, because if you're looking at it from a streaming standpoint, the streaming standpoint right now is 0.0018 cents that you make for every stream. And this is on Rhapsody, this is whatever, which is hardly any money. And it's going up 0.0001 cent a year until 2015, when it gets renegotiated.
You're depressing me, my
Jesus.
Friend.
I feel the weight on my stomach. The more number you tell. Anyway, keep going.
No, okay. Now, but if we go back again and just take away the online stuff out of this.
Right.
Rebecca Black actually made a bunch of dough, because the song was on Glee. She was on Good Morning America. She was on. She did, all the late night shows, all the early morning shows. So just from that, there was a whole bunch of dough that came in. Plus, there was a lot of iTunes sales. And just from the iTunes sales, was it $1 million? No. As I understand it, it was, a couple hundred grand.
Is there Rebecca Black merchandise?
I don't know that.
Because you'd think they'd probably make bank on that, right?
She would, and you would think
her people.
Well, I do know that her parents, there's a lawsuit between them and ARC and the whole thing. So it's just getting messy. It's like what Rob was talking about on the on that one podcast, that you really got to go.
Did they say
what
was the issue or the core of the lawsuit? Or
You know, you can look it up. It does. I don't remember, but they did mention what the deal
you know what? It has to be something. I don't know specifically, but the biggest mistake that parents always make in these situations is when you're hiring producers or songwriters or teaming your kid up with young producers or whatever. You never pre-negotiate who owns the song, who owns the master, and it has to be coming down to that. Because especially, did she do the song on Glee or did they? They covered it on Glee because
I don't know.
Then all that matters is who owns the song. Yeah. If they're not using her version, you know, she may own the master but not the sync. And there's just a whole bunch of basic things that you have to know if you're getting your kid into this situation.
Yeah, I'm just now trying to look it up.
Well, but then again, it was the songwriters that get paid on that because no matter which way you looked at it, no matter who owned the... They're still going to make money. The songwriters are still going to make some of the money.
I've just looked it up right now, and it's like they're accusing the Los Angeles producers, Art Music Factory, of copyright infringement and and unlawful exploitation of her likeness and song on YouTube, iTunes, Amazon, and the ARC's website. I mean, basically, they're accusing,
they're getting greedy. They're saying,
"Yeah, the parents are now
copyright infringement." Yeah.
You know what? I wouldn't want to. Yeah. I wouldn't want to have an intellectual fight with whoever came up with those lyrics.
And where have your head with that one?
Yeah, that'll make World of Warcraft look pretty tame. But
you know, talk about biting the hand that feeds you. They're basically suing because she got famous.
That's right, exactly.
And it's like, listen, they did a favor for your kid because, like you said, if they just do a few little things, they can cash in.
But it's like the stories of TLC. They had these hit albums. Somebody was making a lot of money, and they weren't.
Yeah.
So it's something like it, which is, it's always interesting because on one hand, you're the talent. On the other hand, they go, yeah, but nobody knows who you are. Nobody will ever know who you are until I make that happen. So the question is, who is worth more, the distributor or the artist? And that's a fight that's been happening to the end of time.
Yeah,
well, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But thank you, Bobby, for your insight in depressing me.
Well, you want to get more depressed? Okay.
Sure.
I'll make you even more depressed. So, okay, what you're making from your streaming royalties is 0.00.
So how much are we making on this show, Mike?
Okay, 0.0018 cents a play. You have to split it with your publisher.
Nice.
Absolutely.
So take everything divided by half. Yeah.
That's right.
A bag of candy. It's much better deal at this point.
But now we can take it another step even.
Agent.
The publisher has to make an accounting of all that. So the publisher, and there's no electronic way to do this yet, which is even crazier.
What?
It's all done manually, and basically what happens is a publisher gets a stack of paper in, and it has to be manually fed into the system and then shot out to every one of their clients.
Yeah.
So what ends up happening is they're losing tons of money on this. If you go even further, wait until the record labels get involved because there aren't, again, it's a contract right now that doesn't stipulate what happens in the streaming days.
All right.
So this 0.0018 cents, it's coming down.
All right.
God knows how much money is actually going to make it to the artist when it's all said and done.
Wow. Now I'm really
depressed. Now you can get really depressed.
So after expenses and everything else, it's,
Buy yourself a cup of coffee.
If you're lucky.
You have to always keep in mind what is your product and what is the commercial for your product.
Yeah.
And all of this YouTube stuff should be the commercial for all the stuff you do
That's
true.
Absolutely right.
And you know what? On that note, which is kind of optimistic.
If that's optimistic, we're in bad shape.
We're going to wrap up this one. Oh, you know what? Before we wrap up, though, a couple announcements. Number one, we actually gave away something on the podcast.
Yay.
The shirts for the API swag actually made it to the winners, and I was kind of proud of that.
Nice. and did you hear back from them?
Yes, and awesome. In celebration of the fact that we successfully did a giveaway, we're going to do another one.
Wow.
Nice.
We are going to do another one. And so we're going to give away
Lunch with Mike.
Autographed copy of one of Bobby Osinski's books.
Oh, there it is.
Nice. All right.
And
who's going to autograph it?
No, we'll get the winner. Well, maybe everyone should. Maybe the panel should.
Yeah, we'll autograph it. Well, that's very generous.
Interesting
Thank
idea.
You. And the book that we're going to give away first is why don't you tell us the book?
Oh, it's one of the latest ones. It's The Ultimate Guitar Tone Handbook. Ooh. And what this is about is everything about guitar tone, from the instrument, why an instrument sounds the way it sounds, to an amplifier, why an amplifier sound or amplifiers sound good, bad, whatever, acoustic guitars, whatever. And so it's, and also miking technique, production techniques, all those things, so you can get the sound of the guitar the way you hear it in your head or on records, first of all, in the room, and then record it that way.
That's the grail quest for guitar players. Yeah. I know guitar players. That's by the way.
Yeah, that's exactly.
So if you want to get the autographed copy, all you need to do is send in an email to audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And we're just going to randomly generate a number. And whatever number we generate, we're just going to count down that many. And that person's going to get the book. So,
so the four people that listen to the show, we get
$100.
Yeah, it's a pretty good bet. We get the 7 emails we get. It'll be 1 through 7. But so if
had a pretty good response for the t-shirts, right?
Yeah, we did. So hopefully 5? we'll get it. We got 8.
Whoa, yes.
So just send in an email, audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And you know what? I'm just going to count every email. So spam the whole thing. So some guy in China may get a book. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. But send an email, audio@nowcastnetwork.com. All right, before we go, Rob, you working on anything you can talk about?
Sort of partially. Actually, I'm working on a Stevie Wonder thing that we'll be able to talk about more eventually, but it's good to be doing that stuff. A lot of the Google stuff that I've been working on for a while, I've started to see sort of trickles of information coming out. They had the Google I.O. conference this week.
Yep.
And I'm seeing trickles of information about some of the stuff that I've been working on. So, pretty soon it'll be public. So if you see news from Google about new stuff going on, chances are that's what we've been working on.
Nice.
And my guess is in the next couple podcasts, it'll all be totally public and we can talk about it.
Great. Jason, how about you? Are you working on any titles or did you finish a title you can talk about? Or,
you know, I'm working on the new unannounced massively multiplayer online game for Carbine Studios, but it's unannounced, and so in the game industry they're very tight-lipped. But so, it's going to be great.
You're doing some cool things for a big game that we can't talk about.
Yeah!
Hey, join the club. Everybody else says the same
thing. Well, except he at least confirmed that it is unannounced.
That's
some information.
Hey, Tim! How you doing, man?
Doing great.
Did you enjoy your time sitting around the table?
Yeah, it's fun.
Are you working on anything?
I'm working on a record that's also under lock and key.
Do you play games?
Yeah, I play some games too. Play some online games. Had a chance to play World of Warcraft.
So, nice.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Alliance or Horde?
Alliance.
Really?
Yeah.
How high did you get?
Level 3.
How about you? How high did you get?
Oh, most of my game playing of WoW is all pre-release. So, honestly, I watch over people's shoulders more than anything else. So, I've never been the hardcore WoW player. I keep threatening to get in now that I've had enough time between working on it, you know, and get in there and maybe enjoy it, especially now that it's all changed. So, never really got a character up very high at all.
Did you ever play Diego?
No. But I heard about it, I read about it and everything. I still love pinball machines. I need gear. I need a heavy piece of metal that I can shake. That's my kind of video game.
You know what? I can totally relate to that.
I need to hammer the glass if things don't go the way I want. You know?
Tilt.
Yes, tilt is my favorite part of the game.
Are you working on anything?
Yeah, I'm working on a couple of projects that I can't say anything, of course, but I can tell you that the other day I was walking on the street and I picked up a huge stick that fell from a tree, and so I'm building a new instrument. I had the idea for how the thing would work, and I have no idea how it's going to end, but I think it's going to be cool. And,
and it makes it sound by falling out of the sky and killing people.
Yes. Most likely, it's a new kind of sound.
I'm going to plug Diego. He by the time this publishes... He's going to be in the video on the API website for the DTS sound signature.
Oh, yes.
And we shot a video, and Diego goes into some details, some of the API gear that he uses.
I look like a priest because I wore a white T-shirt under the the sweater. So
we call him Father Diego.
Yes, Father Diego. No, but Mike was filming. He did a great job. Really very cool with the lights and everything.
Nice.
Very nice.
Scott, how about you? Are you going to join it? I can't talk about it.
Yeah, for the most part. No, I can say I finally finished everything being green. Green Lantern, for my part, it is done.
Nice.
And right now we're mixing away and should be in the theater near you, I think relatively soon.
Yeah.
I think the trailers are been slamming, coming out quite a bit. And I'm on to something else that's wicked fun, but of course.
Yeah.
I can't talk about
Bobby.
Well, I can't talk about some of these things. I've been very busy in pre-production for a record that I'm producing. There's a couple of music television shows, 3D music television shows.
Wow.
That I'm getting ready to produce. Hopefully they'll come to fruition, but it's looking good. And I just finished the second edition of the Music 3.0 book. And I'm still working on the memoirs with producer-engineer Ken Scott for that book, which will be a huge amount of fun.
That's great. Really envy your forthcoming nature. You can reveal everything you're working on.
That's great.
That's awesome. Good job. Well,
and what are you working on there, Mike?
Yeah, Mike.
Well, I already told you about the commercials that I can't talk about.
Say that again.
But you know what I am working on? I'm going on vacation this summer and I already booked all my travel plans.
Where are you going?
We're going to...
You can't say. I know.
I'm going to Wisconsin for a big family gathering. We're taking the train out there. And then we're going to be flying back. The train ride is going to be, it's about 3 days. You leave at 6:15 and you, on one day, you spend that night, next day.
With the kids?
Spend the night. Yeah. And, no, it's gonna, you know what? It's, I am looking forward to not being able to, you know, be in contact with anybody and not having to do anything.
You bring lots of DS and...
Well, it's funny you should say that. Right now, I'm totally prepared.
World of Warcraft online.
What I'm going to take. I have a little computer and I'm going to do a little bit of music, you know, because come on, you got to take your...
Yeah, 3 days.
Music and stuff. But it's actually kind of fun as I'm kind of putting this whole little kit together. I'm like, okay, I don't want to carry a lot of stuff, but I want to be able to write. So I'm probably going to just have... I'm probably going to take Propeller Head's Reason. I'm going to use Reason. I'm going to use probably Ableton, and then use the Master Collection from Native Instruments. And
so your kids will be on that. So what are you going to be doing?
No, because you know it's we have little sleeper cars, and so we'll be able to just be isolated and you know hang out with the kids, and then at night do just a little bit of writing. I think it's gonna be really cool. I'm looking forward to just chill time. I don't know about you guys, but it's sometimes great. I work so much, and so just being
about.
Able to chill and just take it
What's
easy.
What's that?
Exactly. If you have the time, and if you've ever want to take a trip and really kind of refresh yourself, doing a long distance train trip with the sleeper cars, don't go coach. Been there, done that. Never do it again. But with a sleeper car, because it's really comfortable, and you just kind of watch you know the land go by.
Sounds
you
like
watch
fun.
It. Yeah,
it sounds really cool.
It's a great idea. Anyhow, well, hey, I just want to say if you have any questions or comments for any of the guys, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com, audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And you know what? If you send us an email right now, you'll be entered in that contest, ooh, whether you like it or not. So. Also, be sure to check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/audionowcast. And that's about it. So,
and Jason, do you have a page where people can check out some of your stuff or...
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's been pretty neglected with everything I've been doing lately, but musicbyjason.com is my website.
Yeah, cool. We'll post a link to it, and I'll put a link to the trailer for the original World of Warcraft one.
Cool.
Because that was great music on that one, so that would be good. And so for myself and all the guys, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time. We'll be right back.
Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.